So let's go back and let's think about what we spoke about last time. There were some things which were disturbing, but let's start again, really, from the beginning. My starting point last week was saying that I want to try to consider how Esther impacted later discourse in terms of halacha. And that may seem, like a really random kind of question, but the reason why I present it is because there is really a great deal of literature. Now, the reason that most of this literature exists is because of an assumption, and it's an assumption which I personally think is not a very easy point. And I think if it's tradition, then I have nothing to say. If it's somebody guessed it, then I think it's a little bit harder to say it. And that is that Esther and Mordechai were in fact married, and therefore Esther was a married woman. And if Esther is a married woman, then it changes somewhat the complexion of the story. And actually, I'll say it again, I said this last time, it actually runs, counter to at least part of the story, because part of the story was to collect all the young single women. So therefore, how could you say that she was married? So I consider that to be a problem. Nonetheless, I'll say it again. If this is tradition, this is tradition. Now, part of what we tried to figure out last time, and I'm going to say it again, we had a hard time. And to be perfectly honest, many of the young men here had a harder time than the women did. And frankly, some of the women were quite surprised at some of the responses of the men, which is good, because it's about time that people realize what this world is really like, unfortunately. And that question was, what exactly constitutes consent? What constitutes duress? What constitutes rape, for that matter? And again, I'll warn you that there are all kinds of triggers over here and all kinds of things, so be forewarned. The case that we began with was a case which is taught by someone known as Rabbi Yaakov Reicher. He wrote a book, Sheilot V'Tshuvot, Responsa, which means questions and answers, called the Shvut Yaakov. And I'm going to open it up and we'll take a look again together at the question that he raises. But the difference this time is we're going to start moving towards a response as well. Source 12, Shvut Yaakov, Chelek Bet, Siman Kuf Yud Zayin. You see Rabbi Jacob ben Yosef Reicher, born in 1670 in Prague. Sheila, Maaseh Shehaya Kachaya. The case that happened is as follows. Siyasha bnei Adam shalchu b'derech. A group of people traveled along the way. The echad mehem, and one of them, Ishto imo, his wife was with him. The yil et erev, and in the evening, v'hochu l'malon achad samoch liar, they went to a place to stay on the side of the road, u'matzusham anshei bli'al, and these godless men found them, rotzchanim, murderous people, shehem ha'moadim harog defashot ha'eskei mamon, people who would rob you and kill you. Why leave witnesses around? Ukashera ashet saratan tsara, when they realized the difficulty of the situation, shamdu aleihem laharogotam, they realized that they're all going to be killed, v'lo shamu b'tchananim aleihem, yitchananu aleihem, and the robbers didn't listen to their pleas, al nafshotam, when they pleaded for their lives, az hefkera atzmahi isha, one of the women decided to make herself available. In English, she seduced one of the robbers, biritzon ba'ala, and her husband agreed. By the way, that's one of the things I would like to discuss, if that makes any difference, that the husband agrees or disagrees. Biritzon ba'ala Yisrael, v'yedei kein, and because of this, he stila otam, she saved all the people. V'achshav baba Allah lish'ol, and now the husband comes and asks the question, yi ishto muteret lo, if she is allowed to him, kevan shana'asa mitzad ones, because the thing which happened. Now, the word ones literally means rape, so, but I don't know if I want to translate it now as rape or as duress, because the thing which happened against her will, or ones ritzicha, which is really a convenient way of phrasing the question. You say, no, she did this because she did not want to be killed. Birtsona, but she did this willfully. So this whole turn of phrase here is what is so difficult and contradictory. And again, I'll explain all the issues in a second. Ve'eshi Yisrael shenensa muteret labala. O yekabel skar la prisha v'ketzit nehegima. Or should she be rewarded for what she did and then they need to separate. So let me explain. In Jewish law, if a woman has an affair on her husband, and by the way, there's actually Jewish law has lots of other details. One of the details is, and this may be counter to some of our imagination, but that is that you actually need there to be evidence. So there is a difference between historical truth and halachic truth. Halachic truth, you need two witnesses. You need two witnesses, again, for which part, entering a room or so on. But I'm just saying this as a whole technicality in terms of this whole issue, which I'm not going to get into that much. But if a woman is raped, then it does not impact the marriage. But if a woman cheats on her husband, that is essentially spousal malpractice. And then the husband, again, assuming that he knew about it, would have to divorce his wife. And that's the question which is put up over here. The husband certainly is aware of what happened because he was there. And he's quite aware of what happened. So he's saying, is this, he goes and asks the question, is this considered to be rape or is this going to be something else? And the way the question is phrased, well, it is onus means against the will. It was against her will, but was it against her will? Which means that's why this is complicated. And this is really where we got stuck to a great extent last week, because this on the one hand is duress. She does not want to do that. On the other hand, she wanted to save her life. And there's another element in all of this, and that is that the guy, he was happy to kill them. Meaning that she survived is because of what she did. So therefore, this is not the same thing as somebody saying, giving you a choice. There's no choice over here. She went and initiated sexual contact with this individual because she thought this would be a chance to save her life. Now there's actually two questions that need to be asked. First question is, did she do the right thing? And by the way, I'm asking that question right now, devoid of any other part of the discussion. I'm saying, quite simply, did she do the right thing? And that we have to analyze at least a bit. Second question is, if she did the right thing, does it impact the marriage? Now, this is why the story of Esther is important, because one of the things that we saw last time is that in the Esther story, when she says "Kasher avadati avadati," that is when she goes in to save the life of the rest of the Jews. She then goes initiate some kind of a contact with Achashverosh. And as far as the Gemara was concerned, until this point, any contact she had with Achashverosh was considered to be rape. But at this point, she goes in willfully. So therefore, maybe this is going to be a direct parallel of the Esther story. First of all, by the way, I'm sorry for ruining the Esther story because we like learning it as kids, and therefore there's nothing salacious about it, but the way the Gemara reads it, there actually is something which is, you know, this whole other aspect to it. So again, two questions. One, did she do the right thing? Two, is does this impact the marriage? And the way the question was phrased, it never considered for a moment that she didn't do the right thing. The question never considers that. First point, maybe she's wrong. Maybe, you know, we learned that there's three things that you give up your life for. One of the things is considered to be illicit sexual contact. Over here, a married woman offering herself to somebody to save her life. So maybe that's something which is wrong. Maybe it's something which is not going to be allowed to do. So that is going to be our problem. As far as this other issue goes, again, we discussed this a little bit last time. On a legal level, as far as I understand, if a person breaks into a house and puts a gun to people's heads and there ends up being sexual contact between him and one of the people, it is most likely that when he gets arrested, he'll get arrested for using a weapon, he'll get arrested for robbery, and he'll get arrested for rape, because the rape is going to be the illegitimate fruit of the crime that took place. And when you have somebody locked in a room and you have a gun on them, so then one can very well assume that the sexual contact was one which was not done of free choice. I go back to this word consent. I go back to this word duress. And over here, it'd certainly be considered both duress and lack of consent. And therefore, the robber should say, well, she offered herself. Well, you fool, she offered herself not because you're good looking, and not because she liked you, and not because she found you amusing. There was sexual contact because she was scared you would kill her. And therefore, legally, I'll say it again, that may very well, most likely, would be considered to be rape. But my problem is not American law. My problem really is going to be in terms of Jewish law. How do you define this? And the way the questioner questioned or phrased the question to the Shvat Yaakov was really that he used the word onus, he used the word rape in his formulation and said that this was done against her will in order to save lives, which of course is morally confusing because make up your mind, which one is it? Is it against her will or was this her will? So the answer, unfortunately, is both. Up to this point, any questions or comments or thoughts? In order to resolve the question, and by the way, I'm skipping over the more fundamental issue, and that is, was this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? I skipped that so far. Because the Shvat Yaakov, in his response, doesn't deal with that question. He just assumes she did the right thing, which I'm going to say it again. Okay, he's convinced of this. I don't know yet why he's convinced of it. So let's take a look at what the Shvat Yaakov actually does. First, he poses the question, and then he writes tshuva. Hinei l'cha'ora, it would seem to be, din ze pashut. Okay, it's simple. So all of you who thought that this was a complicated question, the Shvat Yaakov, no, this is not complicated. Din ze pashut va'aruch l'faneinu b'tshuva maharik. He says, no, you want to understand this. This is really simple, straightforward. And what he's really saying to us is that I have precedent. And the precedent that he has is he says, take a look at a source, which is called the Maharik. So instead of reading everything else that he says over here, what I would like to do is introduce you to the Maharik, which means we went back to hear this question to 1670, right? That's when Reicher was born. But now we're moving back another couple of years. We're going back to the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef ben Shlomo Kolon, 1420 to 1480, lives in France. In France. He was born in France. Eventually, he settled in northern Italy, and he became one of the most important rabbis in Italy. And by the way, this was the time when they burnt the Gemara in Rome, and he became one of the most important rabbis in answering questions. He has a huge, huge influence. I would go so far as to say he was probably the most important rabbi or in terms of giving rulings of halakha in Italy, period. You know, over all of the history of Jews in Italy. So listen to the question that he asks. V'asher sha'al maharil b'isha shezinta tachat bahala b'ratzon. Regarding a woman who, I don't want to use the word cheat, but I want to use the word had an affair while she was married. Biratzon means willfully. Vihi lo yada, and she didn't know. Im yesh isur bedavar, and she didn't know that you're not allowed to do that. Im yechashev shogeg. Ad kan l'shono, if you consider this to be, quote-unquote, an accident. Now, all of you who are saying, that is absurd. How in the world do you have an affair by accident? He says, no, she knew she cheated. So I want to say two things about this. One, there was no women's education. In Italy, in that time, there was probably very limited women's education. So to say that a woman doesn't necessarily know what is allowed and what's not allowed, maybe just with that point is not as absurd. But I want to add a second consideration. People got married really, really young. So as bizarre as this case may seem, is it possible, and again, I'm presenting that it is, but is it possible you can have a girl who's 13, 14 years old, gets married, you know, starts to become sexually intimate with her husband, and then she meets somebody else and she cheats on her husband. And then she says, she's caught. And she says, I'm going to say now, even honestly, she said, I never knew you're not allowed to do that with somebody else. Nobody ever told me that. And as absurd the question is, I actually appreciate it. I appreciate it because we make all kinds of assumptions, right? The Jewish community makes all these assumptions that you can have all kinds of schools and never have any sex education and everyone's going to know everything that they need to know because it's just somehow it happens. So to think about a girl who would have lived hundreds of years ago and nobody ever had this conversation with her and somebody just kind of expected, of course, everybody knows this. Well, not everybody knows everything that everyone is supposed to know if nobody ever taught somebody everything that one is supposed to know. So that's why I really appreciate the question. Now, getting back with what you may consider to be the impossibility or the implausibility of the case, let's consider the case for a second. A young woman comes in front of us and comes in front of the court and says, yes, I cheated on my husband, but I didn't know you're not allowed to do it. So therefore, the word, again, the key word in this formulation was the word shogeg. I hope you recognize the word from the laws of Shabbat. There are two ways of breaking Shabbat. One way is bemazed, on purpose you broke Shabbat. Another way of breaking Shabbat is called shogeg. I didn't know you're not allowed to do that. There's a law. I never know. Nobody ever told me you're not allowed to do such a thing. So therefore, there's a huge difference in terms of Shabbat. If you broke a law of Shabbat on purpose, right, that's considered to be a severe thing. If you broke Shabbat by accident, it's obviously not severe. So what the question is asking is if you have an affair by accident because you didn't know you're not allowed to do that, is that considered to have the same consequences? Or let me put this a little differently. What is the element which makes the husband not allowed to remain married to wife? What makes it malpractice? What makes it spousal malpractice? Is it the fact that you cheated on them? And by the way, I have another question to ask after all of that. What happens if you're not cheating? What happens if the husband says, oh, that's fine with me. Go ahead. Right? I'm too tired. I have a headache. I'm too old. I'm too this. I'm disinterested. I don't really like you. Go ahead and sleep whoever you want to sleep with. Does a husband actually own a wife? And by the way, this goes back to my question before. It says that when they're traveling along the road and the husband agreed that she should do this, does that make any difference? Does a husband have any say on this? By the way, one way or the other. So therefore, if a husband says that it's okay to do this, then it becomes okay. If a husband says it's not okay, then it's not okay. Well, this has nothing to do with a husband. This is God. God said, "You right, do not commit adultery." And that nothing. The husband can't say, I waive my rights. There was actually a rabbi who I know who said that this was one of the most absurd questions, or he couldn't believe the question. He said that he was told this by a religious man, I say quote unquote religious man, who was a person who traveled to different cities, and he did not always keep faithful to his wife. And he goes to a particular city, and he was interested in what some of you would call hooking up. So he seeks out a professional. Somebody tells him, call this and this number, and this woman will come over to your hotel room or whatever. He calls up, and a woman comes in, and it looks like an Orthodox Jewish woman, ultra-Orthodox even. He looks, and he starts to talk to her, and he says, and they both realize they're both Jewish, and he says, are you married? Because she's like wearing a shetel. And she says, yeah, my husband says it's okay with him. And this got this guy not to cheat with her because, again, he had sufficient morals that he didn't want to sleep with a married woman. Again, he didn't mind paying for it with other people. But the question that was asked of this, that he told this rabbi this, that he just couldn't believe it. And part of the discussion then became, does a husband actually have the ability to do this? And by the way, the answer is no. It has nothing to do with the husband. Husband has no rights, as it were, over the wife, which brings me back to the Maharik. Now, what was the answer that the Maharik gave? Okay, this is the important point for us. Let's think of a way of putting this in a sentence that we can now remember the words. He says that we can separate between culpability and consequences. That's your phrase for today. Culpability versus consequences. Culpability means that you're guilty. Consequences, he says, are independent of culpability. So therefore, you can have a situation whereby the woman didn't know she's not allowed to do this, so there's no culpability. Right, you broke a law. You didn't know you broke the law, so there's no culpability because she did this b'shogeg. She did this by accident, not knowing the law makes an accident. So there's a lack of culpability. So his point was lack of culpability doesn't have anything to do with consequences. Now, how does the Maharik know this? This is the important point for us. What's his proof? Answer: Esther. Because he says, Esther certainly did the right thing by being with Ahasuerus, okay, dealing with the moral question. Was it right what Esther did? So he says, of course it's right what Esther did. And therefore, Esther did the right thing. By doing the right thing, there can't really be culpability, right? She's not guilty. She didn't do anything wrong. But rather, there were nonetheless consequences. And that's what that's how we understood the Gemara. The Gemara said that Esther says, Kasher avadati, avadati, as I lost my parents, now I'm going to lose you, because till this point it was against my will, and now it is something which I've done willfully. So therefore, the Maharik solved this question, again, by separating culpability and consequences. You can have consequences when there's no culpability. So now if you want to anticipate, so what exactly did the Shvut Yaakov do? How did the Shvut Yaakov solve his case? How did he solve his question? So he said, essentially, this is the same question. Morally, this woman did the right thing. She saved her lives and all the other lives by sleeping with this person. But unfortunately, she therefore slept with somebody else. She wasn't raped. There was no, right? She initiated this. And therefore, even though there's no culpability, because morally she did the right thing, nonetheless, she can't continue her relationship with her husband because she willfully slept with somebody else. So therefore, I'm going to say it again. We essentially have our Esther case, as understood by the Gemara, dealing then next utilized by the Maharik. Case of the Maharik, to remind us, is the woman who doesn't know that you're not allowed to sleep with somebody else. So again, no culpability, but there are consequences. Then used by the Shvut Yaakov, utilized by him to say, okay, this woman who seduced the robbers, murderers, to save her life and the lives of others, morally did the right thing. And now he's saying, look, we have precedent for this, and therefore she morally did the right thing. But nonetheless, what can I do? She ended up cheating on her husband, and therefore that does impact the marriage in terms of not being able to proceed. Do you all understand what the three steps there or no? Does anybody understand?
I'm a little confused with the fact that you said that she wasn't guilty, but she was willfully sleeping with the robber. Because didn't you say that because there was a gun to her head that it was rape?
Well, I was willing to entertain that possibility. But again, let's say now you're going to be the lawyer for the robber. You're the lawyer for the robber. How would you defend him? Come on, are any of you one day going to become sleazy lawyers who will defend murderers, robbers, and rapists? Probably. So what would your defense be? Come on, somebody can do it. Yeah, he'll say, I don't want to sleep with her. What are you talking about? I don't want to sleep with her. I had no interest in her. I wanted to kill her. But she begged and she was nice to me, so I decided not to kill her. He'll say, how can you charge him with rape? I didn't commit rape. I would never commit rape. Like most men would say this, I would never commit rape. But you had a gun to her head.
Right.
So
yeah.
Right.
She chose to live by seducing him.
Yeah, she chose to live. Yeah. Strange choices people make. So again, I understand the difficulty in that case. And that's really a good point. Do we have room in that case to say that, it goes back to another issue, that what exactly is rape and what exactly is duress? And is every case of duress going to be rape? Are you willing to say that every single time that a man goes to a prostitute, it's actually rape because she has no interest in doing this? She's doing this for the money. She's not doing this because of any interest in him. And therefore, there is duress, and she's doing it for money. And therefore, ultimately, it's a case of rape. Or you would say, no, that's no. I just got carried away.
You got carried away.
Okay. Maybe. But where do you draw the line? That's exactly my question. Where do you draw the line? And I would say that rape is something against your will. So you say, okay, define against your will. So this woman initiated contact with him to save her life. So it becomes very difficult to say against her will. No, I'm repeating myself from last week. It's not that she woke up that morning and she put on a little extra makeup and a little extra perfume and said, I really hope I get to meet some sexy robber who'll try to kill me today, and maybe I'll be able to hook up with him. No, that didn't happen. It's not what she wanted. It's not what she's interested in. But nonetheless, when it came to the point of saving her life and the life of others, which maybe is important, maybe not, so at that moment, she feels that she has no choice. So again, okay, let's go back a second. Are you going to say that Esther, when she goes in, I mean, that's really the issue. When Esther goes into Ahasuerus, is she raped at that point or not? Is that considered to be rape? What happens between Esther and Ahasuerus? She goes in and she wants to save the Jewish people. She's going to smile at him and she's going to laugh at his jokes. And she is going to try to become as friendly with him as possible to win over his confidence in order to save her people. So again, what was that a case of rape? See, actually, there's another category that we need to be introduced to. If anybody paid attention to the Haftorah last week, it was mentioned there within the Haftorah, not as exciting as it is in the Gemara, but it really is there. Last week, the Parsha was Bishalach. So Bishalach has Az Yashir, the Shira. So what do you choose as the Haftorah? So they chose the Shira of Dvorah. So in the middle of the Shira of Dvorah, it mentions about a particular woman who did something to help defeat the enemy. And the question is, who was this woman and what exactly did she do? And let's take a look at another Gemara. Okay, this is going to be important to us because the Gemara is going to create a category which is an incredibly difficult, morally confusing category, but nonetheless, and where you draw the line and how you apply it is really going to be difficult. It's source number 10, Gemara in Nazir. Amar Ula, Tamar Zinta, Zimri Zina. You have two people in the Chumash who were guilty of adultery or sexual sins. One was Tamar, who goes and seduces Yehuda. She dresses up as a prostitute and sleeps with Yehuda. And then eventually Mashiach ben David is going to come from that relationship. On the other hand, Zimri Zina. Zimri was the one who slept with this woman outside by the tents and 24,000 people were killed. Tamar Zinta Yatsumi Mena Malachim V'Nevi'im. Tamar sinned and the result was having these really important people. Zimri Zina Nefluah Kamir B'Israel, 24,000 people died. And this is the bizarre conclusion that he has from this, that if you do a sin for the sake of God, for the sake of heaven, that to do a sin for the sake of heaven is better than to do a mitzvah not for the sake of heaven. Now, what in the world does that mean? And I don't know if you could begin to imagine how dangerous this concept is. Let's all be honest. Most of us sin because we're weak. Most of us sin because we have poor judgment. Most of us sin because we make mistakes. How many of us have been able to sin and convince ourselves? By the way, this is the most dangerous person. When you can convince yourself that your sin is actually a mitzvah, it's at that point that it's essentially you're irredeemable. Why? First of all, you'll never do tshuva. Why you'll never do tshuva? Because you're convinced that this terrible thing that you did was actually a wonderful thing that you did. So therefore, but the Gemara just now said, it's better to do a sin for the sake of God than to do a mitzvah for the wrong reason. So shall I continue and read this source? Because I hope that you're all, again, sufficiently disturbed by this. Let's read a little bit more. How can you say doing a mitzvah not for the right reason? Don't we have a teaching that doing a mitzvah not for the right reason, you should do it anyway? You do a mitzvah for the wrong reason, you'll eventually do it for the right reason. You'll become habitualized to do it for a good reason. What exactly is this thing, a mitzvah lo lishma? As it says, and now it quotes, this was Tivurach Minashim Yael Eshet Chaver Akini Minashim Ba'ol Tivurach, that blessed is this woman named Yael. Now what exactly, Man Nashim Shaba'ol, that she is as blessed or more blessed than the women in the tents. So it says, you know, who exactly are these women in the tents? The women in the tents are Sar Rivka Rachav Aleah, Omer Yochanan, Sheva be'ilot ba'al oto rasha ba'oto sha'a. Shenemar bein raglea kara nafal shachav, and so on. Essentially, what it's interpreting the story in Shoftim as saying that this woman, Yael, she happened upon the leader of the enemy, the general of the enemy, and what she did is she seduced him, and she tired him out, and then she murdered him, she killed him, and she saved the Jewish people by killing this person. But how did she get him worn out? So it says over here that she was intimate with him seven times that afternoon. Now, that's the Gemara. That's what the Gemara says. So, and the Gemara said that it's better to do a mitzvah, lo lishma, and says like Ya'el. So hold it, Ya'el did this sexual sin. Now, what's going to end up happening over here in terms of the Gemara's understanding is that Ya'el and Esther are going to be the kinds of people who save the Jews by virtue of doing these sexual sins, and they say, no, that's wonderful, it's a mitzvah lo lishma. So I'm going to stop over here again and say that I hope you all realize how dangerous this is. There was actually a false messiah once called Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, one of the points of his theology is we pretty much have failed by trying to do all the mitzvot and get Mashiach to come by doing all the good deeds. Let's do all the bad deeds now, and then maybe this will get, you know, the redemption. So now, basically licensed to sin. His theology was redemption through sin. He pointed out a great gematria that Mashiach, Mem is 40, Mem 340, Yud 350, right? 350 and Mashiach, 358 is the same gematria as Nachash, as the serpent, 358. So in order to bring redemption, you essentially have to act like the serpent. Bring all sin in the world, and then Mashiach will come. So this is a great theology. This is a great theology. Followers of Shabtai Tzvi, therefore, were guilty of every single sin you can imagine. And some of you have weak imaginations, so all kinds of sins some of you couldn't even begin to imagine. They would eat the inedible parts of a cow called chelev, simply because God said not to eat it. So they did, again, every kind of sin imaginable. So the messianism of Shabtai Tzvi was very much based upon this idea of redemption through sin. And I'm going to say it again. You know, we have enough problems with our Yetzer Hara, with our evil inclinations, and the confusion that goes on in our minds without convincing ourselves that the worst things that we do are actually the best things that we do. So that's why I'm saying is just to try to, you know, to realize that the danger of this particular approach. Nonetheless, there is a Gemara that said that. Just we'll go back there one more time just to look at that passage again. And I mean, it actually says it. So I don't know what else to do. It says, Gedola Avera Lishma b'mitzvah lo lishma. So what exactly is the criteria for this? What are the limitations of this? I'm not getting into right now, but what I do want to do is I want to now bring one more authority, and that is the Noda de Yehuda. The Noda de Yehuda, here you have in source 14, 1713 to 1793. He was the rabbi of Prague, Rav Yecheskel ben Yehuda Landau. Now notice the Shvut Yaakov, that's 1713, 1793. The Shvut Yaakov is dealing with this question 1670 in Prague, born in Prague, and therefore the Noda Yehuda is a little bit afterwards, and he is aware of this, and this bothers him terribly. And he's the one who's finally going to question, you know, how can this really be? Source 14. Umikom makom guf din ze shemutar la'eshet ish leznut beratzon kidei la'atzil nefashot eino Torah. He says, nonetheless, this understanding that one is permitted to commit adultery in order to save people, eino Torah, this is not part of our tradition, it is contrary to Jewish values, you can't make such a claim. V'lo yashar be'inai, And he goes, I don't like what I saw. And it's funny because, we all imagine all the rabbis having perfect memories, but he doesn't. And he writes, I saw it someplace. I'm right now, he's actually on vacation over the summer and he's off in the mountains someplace. He goes, I don't remember exactly where I saw it. So now you realize it was actually the Shvut Yaakov, I believe, that he saw. And he brings over as well the shoot of the Maharik, and that's what we just now saw as his as the present. But Anashim v'Nashim, now he again presents the case to us. There are a number of men and women. I also want you to note how he embellishes the story. The initial story, I don't believe he ever mentioned there were any other women there. What did he say in that first quote? Question. Yeah, just a bunch of people traveling and one woman was there. So he already, was telling the story over and, a bunch of men and a bunch of women. Shalchu baderech, were traveling along the way, v'kam aleihem archilistim echad b'sadeh, and these people attacked them along the side of the road, and chavurot listim with a whole group of robbers, shekamuto, laharog et kulam, and we're going to kill all of them, v'kam isha achat behem, Isha Yifat Toar, I hope you appreciate that. He just said a beautiful woman. How she looked was never described in the earlier source, but again, the Node Behuda's mind is he's reconstructing the case, so now, why not? I guess for the movie as well, they'll have to make her into somebody who is incredibly attractive. Vitchila Lishtadel Ima Ish Rosh Alistim Bidvarim, and she began to flirt with him, to speak to him, Ad Shepitito Bichelkat Lishona, until the flirting, the things that she said, Shenit Avala, that he finally wanted to be with her. Viniva Lobiyar Minhatsad, and by the way, he actually weakens the case a little bit, because it says that she flirted with him, and then he approached her, and then she was intimate with her, Biyar Minhatsad. And therefore, by doing this, she saved her husband and everyone else. And that tshuva, which again is the Shvut Yaakov, he ruled Sheshapir Avda. She behaved properly. Umitzvah Rabbah Avda. And she did a great positive mitzvah. She did a good thing. Sheshildato Lazel Atzil Nefashot. By doing this, by sacrificing, quote unquote, taking one for the team and saving all of these people. Raksha afal pikein, nonetheless, Nesra al Ba'ala, nonetheless, she has to separate from her husband, Vivira Ayami Esther. And the source for this is Esther. So I hope that you appreciate it again. So now you realize why I brought this up within the discussion of Esther, because it becomes very simple logic. If Esther is right, then obviously it creates this this precedent that other people can do the same kinds of things. I want to stop here for a second before I continue. What is your opinion if in the Israeli special secret forces, the equivalent of the CIA, FBI, the Shabak or whatever, what do you think about having a nice Jewish girl becoming an agent? And one of the things she has to do is to go undercover and she has to sleep with the enemy in order to, whatever it is, get nuclear secret codes from Iran or whatever it may be, and will save many lives. So are you going to tell me that this is the right thing to do or it's the wrong thing to do? Or will you tell me, what are you talking about? The Israeli government would never do such a thing. That was a question.
They would.
Okay, they would. So is it the right thing or is this the wrong thing to do? Or was that very different from anything I've said till now? By the way, there was a case in Israel a number of years ago. There was a guy named Mordechai Vanunu. Mordechai Vanunu was he allegedly worked in the alleged Israeli nuclear plant in Dimona. Of course, Israel's never admitted to having a nuclear plant, and therefore somebody can't really have worked, so therefore we needed a bunch of allegeds in there. Anyway, he became this individual who wanted to give over Israeli secrets to other places, and I think he became anti-nuclear activities, so he was going to go and share Israel secrets with other people, and the Israeli secret services lured him onto a boat, But they used a woman, a mysterious blonde, but I believe they used a Russian woman from Russia who wasn't Jewish, and they hired her in order to get him onto the boat. I don't know exactly details of what happened over there, but that is a very famous case. Whether the Israeli government would actually do this or not, I don't think is the question. By the way, would the American government do this? Okay, we'll go further. Would the Russian government do this? Yes, there you have no problem that would happen. So is this, I gave you a very specific case, to try to get into the Iranian, that, I mean, I don't want to say this officially, but that that Israel has done various things and will continue to do various things to make sure that Iran never does really get nuclear capabilities. And if this is the thing that has to happen, is that they have to send somebody in to try to seduce one of the Iranian scientists, is that does that then become the moral thing to do? And by the way, just to make this a little bit fairer, I'm willing to go either way right now, whether it is to send in a male agent, if it were homosexual, connect, or a female agent. We want to make this completely fair in any possible way. Would the Israeli government possibly do that? And if they would, is this the right thing to do? Is this something which is justified? This really comes down to the very old classic, do the ends justify the means? Which means if the... So you're going back to the argument that that I love, and that is that war is different, and that by war we have to win wars, and when it comes to wars, you do whatever it is that you can do. But is that really the case? Which means, are there any limitations to this? It is something which is complete, meaning, obviously, this is what's funny. Obviously, you go to war, you're allowed to kill somebody, but it's not considered murder, because murder is only when you kill somebody and it's not justified. So when you kill somebody during war, it became justified, even if it was collateral damage, it's justified because it's about winning the war. So we actually have three things that you can't do. One is murder, one is idolatry, and one is sexual sins. So therefore, the question that we've been dealing with today, are you allowed to do these sexual sins in order to save to save oneself, in order to save a country, in order to save the world, whatever, however dramatic you want to get over here. So is our discussion today, could it actually be part of a larger discussion in terms of what exactly are the limitations of spies? By the way, a friend of mine really did write an article about this in terms of in Hebrew, unfortunately. But he wrote an article about Israeli spies and the possibility. Once you introduce the concept of aveir lishma, that you're allowed to do a sin for the sake of heaven, and you use Ya'el as your case, that she seduces the general of the other side, and then she kills him in order to win the war. And just in case you're not sure, she's introduced as Ya'el Eshet Chaver. She is a married woman, and she does this. So essentially, you now really do have a precedent staring at you. Although maybe we have to go a little bit further and figure out what are the limitations of that precedent. At least one of the places that discusses this, if I'm not mistaken, it's the writings of the great Hasidic teacher Rav Tzaddik HaKohen from Lublin. He says that one of the things about aveira lishma is that it cannot have any self-gain involved in it. It can't have self-pleasure, it can't have self-gain, which means you're totally doing this l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. And it can't be that you're doing it for your own career move, in order for you to make money, in order for you to do any other personal gain. It has to be like totally, as I said before. The Gemara introduces it by saying it's greater to do a sin for the sake of heaven. So what does it mean for the sake of heaven? The reason you're doing it is exclusively for the sake of heaven than a mitzvah which is done not for the sake of heaven. Which means somebody who does a mitzvah because they're going to gain from this in all kinds of ways, maybe you can argue that that limits the mitzvah. Again, let's just say for argument's sake that if I teach Torah, so it's a mitzvah, and someone says, listen, can you give a class for $5 million? I'll say, sure, I can give a class for $5 million. And it'll be a great class. It'll be worth $5 million. I can do that. But don't you realize how the money somehow cheapens it a little bit? Because then you'll say, no. I mean, does that somehow hurt your mitzvah part of it? So let's go back again now. Because again, I'm hoping that, part of the discussion that I'm having now, it's not just a theoretical discussion. So what happened, again, just think of the various cases that we discussed. The Maharik. So this uneducated girl who doesn't know that you're not allowed to sleep with someone other than your husband, so you can say, what value is there in studying such a case? So I'll go back and say it again. The value of such a case is, am I able to separate between, what was the phrase that I used? Culpability and?
Consequence.
And consequences. Which means, do consequences only deal in cases of culpability? So what we've seemed to have learned today, that no, and again, that was the case of the Ma'arik, and that may very well be the case of Esther as well, that you can have consequences without culpability. Now, going back to our case, the Noda B'Yehuda says, this is ridiculous. How could you put forth an argument that this is okay? By the way, I just now put forth an argument that it's okay. What's the argument? This really dangerous approach, which is called Aveira Lishma, which you realize with this argument, Aveira Lishma, a sin for the sake of heaven, you can destroy Judaism with this. Because then all of us will say, you know what? There's lots of sins I need to do for the sake of heaven. I mean, I'm going to say it again. There goes all morality. There goes everything down the drain. And that's why this limitation of Rav Tzedakah saying it can only be a possibility. It's only on the table even if there is absolutely no personal benefit involved in it. It's the only way you can talk about that. Now, that's a little difficulty by saying no personal benefit if that's going to be if this woman along the side of the road is saving her life, saving her husband's life. That sure sounds like personal benefit, unless now you're going to say to me, no, that's not what we mean by personal benefit. So let's continue in the Noda B'Yehuda and see where and how he takes this. So the Noda B'Yehuda continues, and he says like this, as far as I'm concerned, it's not wrong. V'ani omer, kevin sha'amru chazal, since the rabbi said, b'kol mitra apin, you're allowed to heal yourself, except chutz mi'avodah zara v'gilah v'shvichut tamim, which means if somebody's really sick and says, okay, just do a little idolatry, you can't do that. Somebody says, do gilah rayot. Do you remember the case that we had last time where I told you the creep who got the prescription from his psychiatrist that he needed to sleep with somebody? So no, you can't do that to save your life, but he's going to die. So let him die. V'shvichut tamim, you can't murder somebody to save your life. So the Noda B'Yehuda turns and goes to this classic rabbinic argument that I break Shabbat to save my life. I don't have to keep kosher to save my life. I break every rule in the Torah to save a life. But when it comes to three things, I can't do those three things. Bikol mitrapin chutz me'avodah zara v'gilah v'shvichut tamim. You are able to heal somebody, save somebody, except for through idolatry, sexual sins, and murder. Im kein. Kishem she'ein. He goes, if that's the case, kishem she'ein mitrapin b'shalosh avarot halalu. Just like you can't save yourself by doing these three sins, kach ein matzilin b'em nefashot. So in the same way, you can't save other people. The honest rachmana sharia, the only beisha shakarka olami. The only time that it's allowed is when dealing with literally a case of rape. So this is an important line. And he says part of the reason for this is that if a woman is raped, then she's being passive. This is really an important thought and an important line. Do you get what he just now said? He said that when a woman is raped, it's not sexual intercourse, because sexual intercourse implies that there are two people who are equally involved. And rape is when one is being forced upon the other. And if somebody is forcing on someone the other, that is not called sexual intercourse. That is, in his mind, called rape. He says that when a woman is raped and she's being passive, something is being done to her, right? Then there's something which is called rape. That's also, I think, really important. Also in terms of a current discussion of what exactly is rape versus what is consent. Is consent is when there are two people who have absolute consent. If one person doesn't have consent, you can't say that what's taking place over there is ultimately not going to be rape. And that I think is an important line within the Noda B'Yehuda's understanding. So far, he said, I saw this case. I saw the ruling. I have no idea what he's talking about. That if a woman is raped, that's one thing. But do you realize what he just now said? He said the reason that when a woman is raped, that she didn't have to give up her life, because that's not considered to be, because the fact that something was done to her and she's being passive, she is not doing the thing which is, okay, it's not the same as when there is sexual intercourse, which he's implying is between two people. Again, the consent does make a difference in this. In the Noda Yehuda's mind, literally, and even in defining the act. So I think that that's interesting. He anusa al guf habia. He goes, what is rape? Rape is when somebody is being forced in this action. Aval hecha she'eino anusa al guf habia. When somebody, in terms of the sexual contact, is not being forced. Va'adaraba. The opposite is true in this case. He mishtadelet lezeh. She's the one who initiated it. Latzil nefashot. Lo mikri karka olam. I can't then say that there was no sexual interaction over here when she started the interaction. V'isha v'ish shavim. And in such a case, males and females are the same. V'tahareg v'al ta'avar. And it is better to give up your life. Now he's going to have one problem, which I'm bolding here, but I want to stop and first describe his problem. His problem is that he may have just now thrown Esther under the bus, as they say. Why? Well, if it's wrong to use sexuality to save somebody's life, how in the world did Esther do what she did? Do you understand his problem now? If you just now argue that you're not allowed to use sexuality to save somebody's life, or even a lot of people, so, well, we didn't get to that yet, then Esther is wrong, which means there goes Purim. We have Purim in like 3 weeks from now. We have to save Purim. If we don't save Purim, then there's no drinking this Purim. There's no drinking. This could be a tragedy of incredible consequence. So therefore, we obviously have to save Purim here. And in order to save Purim, we first need to save Esther. So I hope that you realize that the stakes over here are higher than you possibly imagined. Let's continue. Now we have to save Esther. It's good, because Esther saved all the Jews, so now we have to save Esther. The Esther Shani, and Esther's different. Shaita lahat salat klal Yisrael mehaduvat kush. First answer he gives, no, Esther's different because she saved the entire Jewish people. One. Ve'ein lamdin hatzalat yichidim hatzalat klal Yisrael. And it's not proper to make a comparison between saving everybody versus saving some people. Ein lamdin hatzalat yichidim hatzalat klal Yisrael minar v'adzaki mehaduvat kush. Do you like that answer? I don't know how he knows this. You're saying, okay, it's different. Okay, he's saving Esther, but how do you know? I mean, once you say something is morally wrong, why is it morally wrong if the consequences are much higher? What if it's all the Jews except for 3 people, except for 50 people, except for 100 people, except for 1,000 people, which means you have a slippery slope over here. How did you know that this is okay if you just now argue that it's not okay? But I'll say it again, he has to save Esther. Ve'ein, furthermore, ve'ein lamdin hatzalat yichidim meitzalat klal Yisrael. And he says, no, a couple of people is not the same thing as a couple of people. Sorry, just a... Then he adds, Visham haya bahorat Mordechai ubeit dina. And then he adds a second consideration. There, Mordechai and his court gave a ruling. Now, that's really interesting, because he just now turned Mordechai, and it doesn't say this in the text, into being this great rabbi who's sitting on a beit din and his beit din. And I want to go back again. Okay, Mordechai gave permission. This is circular reasoning. By what logic can Mordechai give permission if it's morally wrong? And then he adds, totally ruining that Purim story, v'ulai, and maybe, b'ruach HaKodesh, and maybe on top of everything else, that Mordechai had b'ruach HaKodesh. Now, the whole point of the entire story of Purim is that they did not have nevuah. They didn't have prophecy. They didn't know what it is that God wanted to do. They're guessing over here. Esther, I mean, there's no God, and God does not appear in the entire book of Esther. So look what the Noda Yehuda just now did. He can't lose Esther because we need to keep Esther. So rather he argues that Esther did the right thing, A, 3 reasons. A, because she saved the entire Jewish people. B, because Mordechai and his court gave a ruling that this is the right thing to do. And finally, C, because maybe even there was Ruach HaKodesh, there was some kind of divine message from God that this is the right thing to do. And I'm going to say this again. This is not so simple. No, on the one hand, what I want you to think about, anytime you need to give 3 reasons to explain something, it's not as good as 1 good reason. Which is, you have a reason, so say, no, this is okay. And I'll say this again. I think that the Avera Lishma argument may be a little bit better, but maybe the Noda Yehuda feels he can't give the he can't use the Avera Lishma argument. Because if you do say the Avera Lishma argument, so then why not? Maybe this woman was right. So essentially, here is the breakdown of what we did today. We went back deeper into this case of the woman traveling along the road who seduced the robber and saved her life and other people's lives. The Shvut Yaakov, who introduced the case to us, said, go back and look at the Maharik. And what do you see when you look at the Maharik? You come to this realization that it was the right thing to do. Precedent is Esther. So it's the right thing to do. But even though it's the right thing to do, it can still have consequences. Which means that even though you're not guilty for having sinned, even though you're not guilty for having done the wrong thing, right? And the case of the Maharik itself was the woman who thought you were allowed to sleep with other people. Okay, perhaps no culpability, but there's still consequences. In this case as well, the case of the Shvut Yaakov, so no culpability. She did the right thing. She didn't do Gilui Arayot. That's what's interesting, according to what he's saying. He's saying, no, there's no Gilui Arayot. She didn't do anything wrong over here, but nonetheless, there are consequences. On the other hand, the Noda Behuda says, no, that's insane. How can you say there was no Gilui Arayot? There's only time there's no Gilui Arayot is in the case of rape. And why in a case of rape? Because a case of rape has, by definition, a lack of equality to it, because something is done to somebody as opposed to two people doing something together. And therefore, the Noda Behuda is saying that no, this is not a case of rape, by definition, because rape means the action is an action of rape, and in this case, quite the opposite. This woman seduced him, and therefore he has a hard time saying that this is a case of rape. Duress, you could say, but there was consent. So ultimately, not only was there consent, there was a seduction over here, and therefore the Noda Behuda says, no, this is morally the wrong thing. But now there's consequences of the Noda Behuda. What are the consequences of the Noda Behuda? We just now lost Esther. So he can't finish this without now trying to somehow save Esther. And the way that he saves Esther is by giving these three arguments that he puts together, which I think are all interrelated. One argument is that, no, if you save the entire Jewish people, that's different. By the way, that may be not all that different from our argument in a time of war. Maybe war is that kind of argument to save the entire people. Maybe the war issue is that when people are at war, then there are so many more lives at stake, and maybe that's really what he's trying to tell us, that if you save 6 people, it's not necessarily, or 20 people, it's not the same thing as a war taking place. Because again, the case of Yael was a case of something which took place by a war, and if it took place by a war, then it changes things somewhat. So again, that argument I'm going to keep on coming back to, that maybe situations of war already change the situation, which, by the way, that now opens up the case. What happens to the spy? Maybe the spy is a little different. And this whole category of Avera Lishma is a scary category because the consequences are really, you know, uncontrollable where it could possibly go. So the Noda Behuda then argues, again, to save everybody is not the same as saving an individual. Therefore, he thinks this woman did the wrong thing. And he says Esther is different because Esther had her rabbi tell her it's okay. But a rabbi can only say what's okay, which is really okay, which is, again, why this is a little circular. And says maybe even Ruach HaKodesh, which is something I can't argue with. But Ruach HaKodesh sort of flies in the face, right? God spoke and told them what to do. So if God said what to do, that sort of ruins the whole story of Esther, because the whole story of Esther is a time of Hester Panim, where we don't know exactly what it is that God wanted us to do, and that kind of ruins everything. Now, I did not keep my word. Did you notice that I didn't keep my word? Where everybody already forgot what I said last week. I told you I was going to teach you the most ridiculous case that you ever learned, and you're never going to forget it, and I didn't get there. So the really dramatic, crazy case, we're only going to get up to next week. That's what we're going to start with. It's going to be a new case, but it's going to allow us to look at everything that we've done so far and do it a little bit deeper and get to places that we were just not able to get to till this point. Okay, so we will take attendance the same way that we did the last couple of weeks. Please send me a text message with what you found most intriguing in the class today, and then I'll know that you were here and you were listening.